Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the movie review podcast, where things go boom.
You make it sound so much more salacious than, like, the nerdy shit we're about to delve into.
We're about to get into such nerdy shit, you guys. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. I write for The Wrap. I write for Film Verdict. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I write for Slash Film. I don't have a nickname. I don't need one. I'm such an unimpressive critic that I'm not even getting, like, angry letters anymore.
Oh, man.
I guess my takes aren't, like, controversial anymore.
Maybe people just know you by now.
Yeah, maybe. Oh, you know what? I wrote a review. Like, I actually got to write the official Slash Film review for Madame Web.
Ah, good days.
Which, you and I were, like, some of the rare critics to give it, like, a semi-positive review.
We thought it was mediocre. Like, we don't understand. Like, it's not worth getting angry about.
It's a passable entertainment, I thought. It's a sloppy film, to be sure, but...
Sure. Studio Notes the movie, yeah.
It feels like Studio Notes, but in a way that I feel is totally harmless. I started my review, I like to contextualize my reviews, start my reviews with a little bit of background as to, you know, what the genre or the filmmaker, actor, whatever I'm...
I do something similar. I want people to know, like, get in my headspace, like, here's where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
And sometimes that means talking about the genre, sometimes that means talking about the history of it, sometimes it means talking about... Just whatever weird headspace I was in when I went into the theater.
Or just, like, where the placement of that film is in the current pop canon. And,
yeah, here's why I'm going to be reviewing it the way I'm reviewing it.
Yeah. Oh, and you're dropping stuff, too.
I am dropping stuff.
So in order to get a little bit of context about Madame Web, and I think I did this on the podcast as well, I said Madame Web is a film that comes sort of in the twilight of the superhero genre.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're on the descending slope. We're kind of... Mm-hmm. Finishing off the last of this genre.
Yeah.
And I did get an angry, probably on Twitter, somebody just saying, the premise of this article is flawed. It assumes that we're done with superheroes. I'm like, look around, dude. I mean, really?
I think, if nothing else, it's clear that you think we're done with superheroes, and that's an important thing for the reader of the review to understand. Here's where this film critic is coming from.
Yeah.
And certainly, we are not at the apex of the medium. Can we all agree on that, at least?
I don't think the bigger films are still ahead of us.
I'm not saying it will never... it'll never heat up again, but
there'll still be a few hits here and there. That's what I'm gonna say. The Marvels and the DCs are still gonna put out a couple more. I know
they're not gonna go away. They're too ingrained.
They're gonna try another Superman universe. That's not gonna be big.
No studio wants to lose their rights to their superheroes, even if the genre is on the decline.
My guess is we're gonna have a big opening for that new Superman movie.
Sure, probably.
And people will talk about it, but get really excited about it, and it'll taper off real fast. It's not going to be as big a hit as the studio wants, and they're going to start rewriting this, like, massive calendar of upcoming superhero movies, and it's going to say, okay.
Did the exact same thing that did last time. I suspect Deadpool 3 is going to do well.
Deadpool 3 is going to do
And then people are going to think, it's back, baby, and they're like, no, that's...
Now, these are, like, that's last hurrahs, you know?
That's got a built-in audience, you know? Anyway, that's a whole... We can have that conversation anytime.
Well, this is going to parlay...
Is it really?
...into Kung Fu Panda 4.
But we're not getting to that yet, because we have to introduce... Produce the podcast, at least.
All right.
This week on Critically Acclaimed, we're going to be reviewing the new releases. Whitney already spoiled it, Kung Fu Panda 4. Or, you know, the title of the podcast spoiled it. I don't know what you read.
I can't really spoil that. I didn't ruin anything.
The new movie about love, lies, and bleeding. It's called Love, Lies, Bleeding. The new Ricky Stenicki film. It's called Ricky Stenicki. And a new film about a dreamer in America who is an American dreamer. I guess. I don't actually know what that was.
Well done. Thank you. Good, some broad context.
Sometimes I only go off the title. And also, we're going to be talking about the aftermath of the Oscars 2024. On the previous episode of Critically Acclaimed, Whitney and I gave our predictions.
Yes.
It used to be a... bless you. It used to be a proper wager. Bless you. We would gamble. We would have to do some unpleasant film critic chore, do a commentary track for I, Frankenstein, something like that. We're past that now. It is a gentleman's agreement, and it's just basically kudos to you. And actually, we both did really well this year.
I tend to do very poorly at predicting the Oscars, so I'm surprised I did as well as I did. You, however, still beat me.
Yeah, no, I did about as well as I've ever done. There were 23 categories, and I accurately predicted 20 of them. So if any of you were basing your office pools on our predictions, I was the one to go with this year. I hope it worked out for you. I haven't seen anyone claim that they predicted more than 20. There's one critic on Gold Derby who got 20 out of 23.
Wow, okay.
On a previous occasion, I did slightly better, but also kind of the same. Back when there were 24 categories, I got 21 right. So I still missed three, but I got one more accurate. But you did. What did you, you end up with? Like what?
15.
Was it only 15? That's still good. Well, though.
You said it was 17, but I recounted. I think I only got 15 of the 20. Okay, well,
fair enough. Well, in any case, that's a whole thing. That's a whole thing we did. And the Oscars. I will say this about the Oscars.
Hmm.
It was a better show than usual this year.
I always love reading the postmortems, like the following day. What did people think of this? Because I can never tell how people are going to react to a show. Usually, they're the Oscars. You know, there's some are okay, some aren't so great, some are a little better.
They have a highlight or two.
Yeah, but they're mostly kind of just the show I want to watch.
Yeah.
But then I go online and read, like, the... Or go to the newspapers and...
always the worst one ever.
And yeah, it's like, the Academy totally whiffed it this year. It's like, I mean, as usual, I guess.
It's never been... there were times when it felt like a great show, but it feels like the times when we called it a great show were times when we had fewer entertainment options.
Uh-huh.
And the Oscars haven't changed a ton. They try altering the format, they try mixing things up. Sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. But it's still... here's a bunch of celebrities giving each other awards.
Mm.
With the occasional comedy sketch, montage, or, you know, sort of playful roast of the people involved. That's always kind of what it is. You're either into that or you're not.
Mm. I heard some people say, why don't we have somebody who just really loves movies host it? Why do we have to get a host like Jimmy Kimmel? Like, because he's a host. He's doing a live show, and he's just moving the show along. He's not there to froth over the movie.
Yeah, no, see, that's the thing. If you don't have an... they did it once without an MC, and it kind of worked okay, but the reason why you have an MC is you want to have someone who's quick-witted, someone who knows how to deliver the comedy, because not everybody who loves movies does, and you want someone who can work with whatever random shit happens.
Yeah,
for example,
quick on their feet.
For example, Jimmy Kimmel hosted it again this year. He's been hit or miss before. I thought he did a pretty good job this year. There was a bit later on in the telecast where it was clearly something that had just happened. And he said, the reviews are already in. And he read this incredibly just badly written, insulting review of the Oscars this year.
Of the ceremony, while it
was still going on. And then it became abundantly clear as he was reading it, who wrote this fucking thing.
Yeah.
And it was Donald Trump. And I don't know if he had this in his back pocket or not, but he said, Donald, isn't it past your jail time? That was a good bit. You have to have someone who's quick-witted in order to make something of that as it happens. So I think he did a good job. His pun game was strong. There was an interesting bit at the beginning where he brought out all of the union guys, the Teamsters, and had all of the celebrities applaud them, which was nice.
Uh-huh.
And he said, "You stood by us when we were striking. I almost said boycott. I knew it was the wrong word.
No, when they're striking.
You stood by us when we were striking. We'll stand by you next year when it looks like you probably will too, which is really really nice. And it kind of puts Hollywood publicly on the hook. It doesn't really engage with the fact that the Oscars were invented as a union-busting measure.
Look, people, that was almost a century ago at this point.
It was, but, and I think this is really important, Louis B. Mayer is one of the people who invented the Academy Awards. And Louis B. Mayer was concerned that as Hollywood became more powerful, and as the people in Hollywood became more powerful, the actors and filmmakers and such, that they would start asking for things like fair wages or reasonable hours. And one of the things he helped implement in order to keep people distracted from collective bargaining, let's invent an award ceremony to keep people distracted for a while out of the year by, like, just, you know, competing for empty accolades. And then they'll be too busy to strike. and the damnedest thing is, we're still doing it.
Yeah.
Like, seriously, half the year is dedicated in this industry to building up to, and then actually building up to the Oscar nominations, and then having the Oscar nominations, you know, drive all of our conversation.
Right.
Even before that, you know, the Sundance is already out there. People are already talking about, oh, well, this is already an Oscar contender for next year. Fucking, we haven't had this one yet. It's a distraction. It can be a fun distraction. You and I both enjoy it, and we acknowledge that regardless of its genesis, it has a place in Hollywood history. We have a whole podcast dedicated to reviewing every film ever nominated for Best Picture. Yeah. It's interesting as a catalog of history. But let's not pretend it's not a huge distraction from more important problems.
Oh, absolutely it is. Yeah. And, you know, it's been called Hollywood's Prom Night. It's a
popularity contest.
There's also, like, an element of posterity to it. It's been going on for so long.
You want to be part of the tradition?
You go to the Kodak Theater, and there's these big metallic plaques of, like, all of the films that have won Best Picture over the years. And it actually does sort of drive the conversation about what the studios are talking about and making.
Yeah.
At the same time, I didn't realize that there were so many people who don't watch a lot of the nominees. Like, they don't make it a point to go see them.
Yeah.
We had a bunch of friends who came over, and they just wanted to come over because it's a party.
Sure.
It's like, oh, well, I saw, like, two nominees this year.
And I think it's fair to point out that one of the best things the Oscars can do is raise awareness of movies. People who didn't know them, like, oh, what's that? That looks interesting. Because not everyone is a hardcore film enthusiast. And when I was younger...
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I was watching the Oscars, and I recognized Beauty and the Beast. I don't know, what's Tom and Viv? Should I check out Tom and Viv? I actually never did check out Tom and Viv, but that was an example of something I didn't know that existed.
Tom and Viv came out when we were still kids, so we wouldn't be interested in a movie like that.
I still watched whatever my parents watched, you know, like, they would rent Remains of the Day, I would watch Remains of the Day, and I didn't grow to appreciate that until later, but, because that's a slow movie for a kid, I think, but eventually, as an adult, I was like, this movie's amazing. So, it worked out. Real fast, it's going to run through the nominees, and we're only going to stop if we think it's worth, if it's noteworthy.
Well, let's just talk about the noteworthy. Well, we need to run down the whole.
I'm literally just going to say it in a sentence. I'm just going to go from the bottom of the Wikipedia page up. I don't have like the order in which they were given out. One of my happiest wins of the night was when Godzilla Minus One won Best Visual Effects.
Yeah, and I voted for the creator. I thought they'd go for that one. Yeah. But I'm glad Godzilla won.
Yeah, my theory on, and I've said this before,
first Academy Award for Godzilla in 70 years.
About time, I might add. And I feel like with Godzilla Minus One, the reason why, some people were really surprised by this, the Academy likes to vote for classy shit. And oftentimes the visual effects category is full of, you know...
Like Napoleon was
in there. Well, Napoleon is an exception to this, but, like, you know, it's also got Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 in there, which was a well-liked movie, but it's not going to be nominated for Best Picture. My theory is the Academy will always vote for whatever is most likely to be nominated for Best Picture. And since Napoleon had no heat behind it, and Godzilla Minus One was actually, like, had, like,
a bit of a hit, kind of
a grassroots buzz, I thought that had a good chance. It worked out. I'm really glad. It's a really good movie, and it deserved it.
I was a little upset that Killers of the Flower Moon got blanked. 10 nominations, nothing, no wins.
Not a single thing.
Same thing happened with The Irishman. 10 nominations, no wins.
Same thing happened with Gangs of New York. 10 nominations, no wins.
Yeah, but Gangs of New York isn't that good.
Gangs of New York should have won production design.
I suppose so.
At the very least, production design.
They built a whole damn city to
make
that movie.
That's an amazing achievement in production design.
Sloppy-ass movie. Like, you can tell that he's been gestating on that one.
And Daniel Day-Lewis is great in it.
Yes.
We can agree on those two things.
As
I like it more than most people, but those are the two highlights.
It's like a Saturday morning cartoon version of... I don't know what the hell he's doing in that movie.
I don't know, but
he's
wonderful.
Fascinating.
Oh, my
fascinating
God.
Fascinating to watch. Like, what is that? What are you doing, Daniel Day-Lewis?
I don't know.
I mean,
he's amazing.
I mean, character. Yeah, as what? The Perilous Purple Pie Man? Who are you playing? You know, it's a weird... I love it, but it's a weird performance.
It's a weird performance.
Yeah, I was really upset about that because I really love Killers of the Flower Moon.
Yeah.
Everyone thought Lily Gladstone was going to win Best Actress.
I know some people who like Emma Stone had won a bunch of awards leading into it. And I thought to myself, it's between those two. They're the only two ones with like a lot of legit heat. Maybe there's a chance for Sandra Hüller, but it was probably those two. And I really thought Lily Gladstone was going to win. A, because people really do like that movie. People really do like Lily Gladstone. It would be a momentous occasion. And, not for nothing, and it's not a meritocracy, unfortunately, it's a brilliant performance. So I was really gung-ho, and that was one of the ones I got wrong. Emma Stone won. To Emma Stone's credit, she looked surprised that she won. Now, then again, she just won a prize for acting, so I suppose she could have been acting. But... That being said, they thought it was more important to give Emma Stone a second Oscar than to give Lily Gladstone her first. And this is something that I think about sometimes, because, you know, I'm on critics' bodies, and I think about, you know, what we give out awards, and sometimes it's about what you think is best, but when everything is good, I think you might want to also consider what was so good that it deserved an award.
Well,
like, of all of these, which one deserved to be singled out as a particular achievement? And I would argue Lily Gladstone's accomplishment in that category was... I mean, no slide to Emma Stone. She's a great actor, but I think in this context, she was more deserving of an award for what she accomplished.
I suppose so. My wife reminded me of this, because my wife is a big Oscars fan. Yeah. She follows the Oscars. She more accurately predicts the winners than I do most years. I think I beat her by one this year, which is an oddity.
Yeah.
They recently expanded the voting body of the Academy Awards. It was a big, the whole Oscars So White campaign called the Academy to reconsider their rules as to who could be eligible, what could be voted for, etc. And in so doing, they actually started to incorporate a lot more European voters.
Just all international
just,
voters.
Just, yeah, and international from voters.
Across all the ponds.
It's an American award. It's put out by the American Academy of Film. When it's just the American Academy, we do want to give a little bit of thought to how the awards reflect on the American film industry.
Yeah.
And there has been a lot of call for diversity in these sorts of votes.
Indeed.
And you can actually see it happening over the last couple of years. There's actually a heck of a lot of diversity in the nominations and in the winners over like the last 6 or 7 years.
It's getting better. Still a ways to go, but it's gotten better. Yeah.
When they started incorporating a lot of Europeans, they don't care about American optics. They don't care about diversity within American cinema. They're just voting for whatever they like. And you'll note, that's probably why someone like Lily Gladstone isn't getting voted for as much, because I think they're more concerned about the European film that was made by the Greek filmmaker.
Yeah, because Killers of Flower Moon is an American
movie. It's an American movie.
Then again, so is Oppenheimer.
Poor Things is... a European movie.
But then again, so was Oppenheimer.
Oppenheimer was also a worldwide blockbuster. That's important to remember.
I suppose that's true. But we have noticed that I think that the influx of international voters, I think you were pointing this out, there's a lot more films that aren't in the English language winning Oscars this year, in addition to, excuse me, I'm still getting over that cold, in addition to Godzilla Minus One, awesome, Anatomy of a Fall won Best Original Screenplay, which was another one I got wrong, but happily so, because that was what I would have wanted to win. Zone of Interest won multiple Academy Awards as well, Best International Feature, and I know this surprised some people, but it's not a surprise if you've seen the movie, Best Sound. And some people are like, but there weren't explosions. That's not all sound can do. That's not all sound can do.
Well, I've done this before. I've voted for something where the single technical element that sold it, that made it interesting, that was like telling a big part of the story.
Yeah.
I voted for that because that's the best. Like maybe a story is being told through the photography or through the music. So I'd vote for music or photography and they would always lose.
Yeah.
The Zone of Interest was told through its sound. It was mostly a movie about sound. And I just assumed, well, because sound is so important in that movie, they're going to vote for something else. They're going to vote for the explosion.
And I would normally agree, but I think in this particular instance, because Zone of Interest was nominated not just for Best International Feature, but also Best Picture, and Best Director, and Best Adapted Screenplay, it felt to me like more people were going to make a point of seeking it out. And I think once you've seen the movie, it's really hard to vote for something else. So that was why I put money on it. But I generally speaking, and I'm going to segue in a second here, it's not the best advice to give the Academy too much credit. Which brings us to Best Animated Short. Best Animated Short ended up going to... There were 5 nominees, 4 of which were really good to great. War is Over won.
And we predicted that one.
We both predicted called this because we weren't giving them credit. War is Over...
Most maudlin.
It's like, imagine if Warhorse were like squeezed together like an accordion. All of that melodrama. I think I described it on Twitter as like, it feels like it was written, I think I might even talk about this in the podcast, it feels like it was written by the 2 shameless studio hacks at the beginning of Frank Darabont's The Majestic, which is a reference most people don't know because nobody's seen that movie. I saw that movie, The Majestic. It was starred Jim Carrey, as a Hollywood screenwriter who loses his memory and ends up in a small town where everyone thinks he's a missing soldier
that had gone missing.
Yeah, like all the young men in this town had gone off to war, and an inordinate number of them had died. And I think it was Martin Landau played the owner of this movie theater, and he thinks that's his son, and he's come back. And he's not, but he doesn't know this, and he gets kind of swept up in the small town and becomes a whole thing. The movie opens with Jim Carrey pitching a movie, and all of these studio executives are saying, oh, but the dog should save them from a well, and at the end they should give an award to the dog. That's the kind of movie War Is Over is. Yeah, you can see that working for some people, but that's not necessarily good storytelling. Yeah, that's just ham-handed.
The premise of War Is Over, we discussed it a couple times. Two soldiers on opposite sides of the trenches during World War I are playing a chess match, which they're conducting via carrier pigeon.
Right.
They both have chess boards. They're writing their moves on a little note. They're sending the carrier pigeon back and forth. Isn't it cute that these enemies in wartime mm-hmm. are now bonding over a game, and everybody gets into it?
Do they even know who they're competing against? Do they even know they're competing against a German or a Brit, for example? They don't necessarily know.
How do you arrange that? That's the weird thing.
That's the thing I kept thinking about. Like, how did this accidentally start?
It's got to be like, when you were in school, did you ever tie a note to a balloon and let it go?
No. I did put a note in a glass bottle once and throw it into the ocean, but I forgot to put a stopper in it, so it's probably just at the bottom
of
the ocean.
It's still in Marina del Rey now.
Yeah.
We did this at school. I said, we're going to fill up helium balloons, tie a note, and just say, hey, if you get this note, send a note back to the school.
Yeah.
And we all let him go, and one person got a note back, and it came all the way from like Tarzana, like it floated pretty far.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
And we started in like over on the west side, and it floated all the way to Tarzana, which mm-hmm. is pretty far distance pretty for
good.
A balloon.
That's pretty good.
And we were all very impressed.
So there you go. But in any case, War Is Over is not a great short. It's a very, very cheesy short. And it's kind of, even though, like, not all the movies that I wanted to win won, that's the only one where I'm like, no, don't do that. But generally speaking, Oppenheimer, as predicted, won most of it. It's a good movie. I like it less than some people, but it's a really good movie. Good for them.
It was on my top 10 of the year. I really loved it. I'm not complaining at all.
I was glad it didn't do a clean sweep and that other movies were able to win some stuff. I was bummed that Barbie only won Best Original Song. I thought it at least had production design in the bag. Mm. That was the third one.
I think I voted for production design and costume, and I lost both of those.
We flipped it. I thought Barbie was going to win production design, and Poor Things was going to win costumes. You thought Poor Things was going to win costumes. You thought Poor Things was going to win production design, and Barbie would win costumes.
Oh, okay.
So I got Poor Things right, but I got Barbie wrong, and you
and vice versa.
Yeah. Whoops. And that's a bummer because it's a hell of a production, and. Sometimes I think that, like, maybe we should all, like, have, like, everyone in the Academy should have, like, little buttons on their chairs, and you vote for Best Original Song, like, right before, just based on the performance. Because I think if that was the case, I'm Just Ken would have won, because they went all out on that thing. That was a delight.
It was a good performance.
Yeah.
It's important to remember that the Academy Awards are a live telecast. It's a live show. It's a stage program, stage show that they're sort of broadcasting to us. And so they're going to have a lot more singing and dancing than you're used to seeing on television.
Yeah, it's an old school sort of almost vaudeville kind of presentation. Here's a new act. Here's a comedy bit.
Yeah, and I'm fine with that.
Yeah, it's fine.
It's being done for the benefit for the people in the room, which I appreciate. There's only a few film segments that made their way inside. Evidently, was it Messy the dog from
Anatomy of a Fall?
There was a really like surreal reaction shot because the dog was in the audience.
Yeah,
and there was a shot where all of the celebrities, like somebody had won, and everybody was clapping. And then there was this brief shot of the dog, and the dog had like puppeted paws, also clapping.
Yeah, that was really cute.
I learned that was like pre-recorded. They edited it in during the live performance, but it was very strange.
Apparently, they wanted to do it live, but in rehearsal, Messy kept barking against Messy. He's a dog, so they pre-recorded it, and the paws clapping was like literally like two fake dog arms on sticks, and the guy was underneath the chair just flapping it. Adorable. You can see behind the scenes photos, and it ended with a shot of Messy peeing on Matt Damon's star at the Hollywood Walk of Fame,
which is a Jimmy Kimmel bit. Like he and Matt Damon have like this fake rivalry.
I kind of thought for a minute I thought they weren't gonna do it. they weren't going to do a Matt Damon joke. Because the last time I think Jimmy Kimmel did it, they did a joke about, you know, the magic of cinema, and it was all about him talking about how We Bought a Zoo was the greatest movie of all time. It was good stuff, actually.
Here's the thing. I really like Matt Damon as an actor. Like, yeah. I'm very impressed with just actor. Sort of his casual delivery. He's like a good Hollywood movie star, as far as I'm concerned. So I'm kind of upset that they didn't do a bit. Like, they didn't bring Matt Damon out.
He might just not have been available. It was a bit of a disappointment that Wes Anderson finally wins an Academy Award. I think it's like his eighth nomination.
Yeah.
And he wasn't there. And everyone's like, oh, what a nice moment. He was like one day away from shooting a film in Europe. Yeah, like, he was literally shooting a film the next morning.
But how cool that he's just making another movie.
That's the best excuse.
He made The Shorts and Asteroid City last year, and now he's just on the way making another one.
If you're gonna not show up to the Academy Awards, a celebration of making movies, what better excuse to have than I'm making a movie?
Yeah.
Great. Good for you.
And it's a live show, which means they can film it badly, and the In Memoriam reel was kind of an embarrassment this year.
The In Memoriam, if you don't really watch the Academy Awards, it's a tradition. Every year, they do a montage of all of the, or theoretically all, but they always leave someone important out. The Hollywood legends and the people behind the scenes whose names you might not know, who passed away in the last year. It's a somber moment. It kind of gives us all an opportunity to sort of reflect on cinema history and, you know, the passage of time and how the Academy Awards, as an annual tradition, helps us mark the passage of time. And every year they fuck it up. And this year they fucked it up, not just by giving up at the end and just putting a whole bunch of names on a placard.
That was my least favorite part. It's like,
you put Kenneth Anger on there. It's like, you put Lance Reddick on there. Young on there. He was nominated for an Oscar. What the shit?
It was the and the rest. Like, these people all die.
But on top of that, because they had people performing live, singers and dancers and an orchestra, they kept trying to frame the montage so that the people at home could see the show. When what we wanted to see was the montage,
yeah.
I don't care about that other shit. I don't. I literally fucking don't. You can play it on a fucking, you know, jukebox for all I care. Just give some respect to cinema history. And this is where, this is my big complaint about this year's Oscars. Because generally speaking, mostly great people won awards. That's always nice. No guarantee. Generally speaking, very funny and entertaining. The John Cena homage to The Streaker. From 50 years ago, that landed. That was very funny. But where they whiffed it every single time was when they attempted to celebrate and acknowledge film history. That happened on three occasions. One, the In Memoriam sequence, where it was all about the show and not about the memoriam. Totally tone deaf. Second, they long ago, like it's like over 10 years ago now, stopped giving out the Lifetime Achievement Awards during the live telecast, which frankly pisses me off, and I think that's a classless move. But they at least showed clips of the people accepting their awards at another ceremony.
Yeah.
This year, they said, we're not showing clips, but if you break out your phones in this five-second window you have here, you can go online and see the
QR code. Yeah.
Fuck you! At least show the fucking clips!
Also, one of the honorees was Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
Who does not want to see Mel Brooks?
Yeah. Angela Bassett as well, for Christ's sake. Say something hilarious. Come on, what the shit? So that was embarrassing. And then the third one, and this is one where on the surface it might have seemed kind of fun, but if you know the full backstory, it wasn't. Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt are about to be in a new movie based on the hit TV series The Fall Guy. Most people don't remember it, but it was an action-adventure series about a stuntman who solved crimes.
I don't think it's based on the TV show.
No, I think it's the same IP.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, I think it's loosely based on it.
I thought it was just had the same title.
No. They've been trying to get that shit made for forever. So they've got a new movie, and it's an action comedy about a stuntman who has to do real adventure.
Oh, yeah, Glenn A. Larson's the Fall Guy.
Yeah, good for them.
Eat my words, all right.
Honestly, the trailer looks fun. Maybe it'll be good. They get out there, and they announce that in order to honor all of the brave, intrepid stunt people who have been the backbone of so much of the industry for over 100 years, and everyone's like, are they going to announce that they're finally going to give them an Academy Award nominee of their own? Like, they've been asking for as long as I can remember, please, we risk our lives for you. Can we please, for the love of God, get some recognition at the Academy Awards? You always said we have too many Academy Awards, and you just made room for casting, so clearly that's not a problem anymore. Maybe this is them publicly apologizing and saying, we're going to give you an Academy Award of your own starting next year. Oh my God, that's awesome. And instead, it was a brief clip show.
Of stunts.
It was a brief clip show of stunts. Brief. And like after like 100 years, you got a 2-minute montage instead of the award you were asking for.
And they've done that
in the past. It was an ad for a movie.
Yeah, for the Fall Guy.
And they probably wouldn't have done it if the Fall Guy wasn't coming out. So also, what the shit is that? I consider that a bit of a slap in the face, frankly.
Again, to go back to our original sentiment, this is... It's all fake. It's all, would it be great for somebody to get recognition? Yeah. But does it really matter if somebody loses? No. I'm still going to watch those movies. I still love Killers of the Flower Moon. I don't care. It didn't win any Academy Awards. I know,
but like, here's the thing. There is this weird class system in place here. And you can even see it, and this is something that I was thinking about. This year, they went back to something they only did one other time, which is when they announced the awards for acting. Mm. Instead of just showing a clip of the performance, other actors who have won the award in the past would say something very glowing about the performer being nominated, whether or not they won.
Yeah.
Hey.
Paul Giamatti was nominated, and Nicolas Cage said some kind things about it.
And I was thinking about this and why this felt so weird to me. And I realize it's a double-edged sword. On one hand, this is probably wonderful for the actors, because four of you aren't going to win, and yet you do get to be recognized by one of your peers, one of the greats, someone who's won this award in the past, in front of everybody. So even if you don't win, at least someone said something really, really nice about you and your work. We in the audience aren't that. So it's kind of just, it kind of feels like we're like invading a private moment. So it's kind of like a little awkward for me to watch that, but it's nice for the actor. But the other thing I was thinking about is this. Only the actors get that.
Mm.
You don't see previous, production. Previous cinematographers saying, hey, good job, Hoyt Van Hoytema. You did a brilliant job with this year's film. And it's like, actors are treated way better.
Mm.
But they're all getting the same Academy Award. There should be, at the very least, a more even presentation. And so, regardless of that, I think it's just symptomatic, that's what I'm looking for, of this overall effect. Not giving the stunt people their own award, it would be so easy to do. Yeah. That's all they're asking for. It's not a lot, honestly. It's add another, like, 5 minutes. And honestly, all the films that would be nominated, they always say, like, oh, they never nominate the fun stuff. It would be the fun stuff.
Yeah, that's... as a kid, I watched the kid-friendly movies, and those tend to have a lot of special effects in them. So those were the ones that the VFX Oscar was the one I was looking forward to.
Exactly.
Those are
the ones you've seen.
I'm old enough to remember a montage of the movie Aliens, which came out in 1986. This is some of the things that they did for Aliens to make it look cool.
God, I can't even remember what. It's the first Academy Awards I remember. I know I used to watch
it. What else came out that year? Was nominated in 1986.
86.
For special effects.
For special effects? I have no idea. That's interesting. I'm looking curious to see what that went up. The
59th Oscars.
Yeah.
what won Best Picture in 1986? That was Platoon.
Yep.
It was Platoon.
Yep. Sigourney Weaver was nominated for Best Actress for Aliens, which was pretty cool. Yes.
Yeah, Oliver Stone won Director. Paul Newman won Actor for The Color of Money.
Mm-hmm.
Marley Matlin won for Children of a Lesser God.
And Sigourney Weaver was up for it.
Yeah, Jane Fonda, Sissy Spacek. Yeah, Sigourney Weaver for Aliens.
Yeah.
Weird.
Nice. She gives a great performance in that movie. It's very rare that they nominate people for genre films.
That's true.
Even this year, like they gave Best Actress to a Frankenstein. They did. Oh my God, we're gonna complete that set. We gave Best Picture to The Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Uh-huh.
We gave Best Actress to a Frankenstein monster. Uh-huh. We're gonna have a classy Dracula or something soon.
Well, Willem Dafoe was nominated for Dracula.
He was, actually. Yeah. That's true. He didn't win, though, which is a shame.
Sound effect. Oh, that's sound effects editor, sorry. Yeah. Animated short.
Excuse me.
Sorry, it's taking a second. Yeah, it is. Oh, best song was Take My Breath Away from Top Gun.
Yeah, it's a good song.
Makeup was The Fly.
Yes, and it was up against Legends, and that's one of the best series in that category.
And do you know what the third nominee was in that category?
I have no idea.
Clan of the Cave Bear.
Yeah, that wasn't going to win.
Aliens was up against Little Shop of Horrors.
Ooh, that had a good visual effect.
And it beat Little Shop of Horrors, which is, that's a bit of a travesty, I'd say.
That's a tough call. Those are both really good.
And
movies.
The third nominee was Poltergeist 2, The Other Side, which actually does have really good special effects.
I can't remember the last time. I think the last time I saw Poltergeist 2, you were doing an article about all the Poltergeist movies.
Yeah.
And I kind of, this is back when we were living in the same apartment complex, and I just sauntered down and caught half of it. I haven't seen that movie since I was a little kid, really. Weird. I had no idea that was nominated for best visual effects. That's hilarious.
Anyway, let's move on.
That's it. The Academy Awards. There were more things to talk about. We could go on forever, but the cool thing about the Academy Awards is that they end, and now we get to actually talk about not the Academy Awards. And there's going to be so many movies at the Academy Awards that we kept talking about just because they were nominated. People thought they were going to be nominated, and now that it's all over, give it 6 months. We'll see which of these movies we actually remember.
Yeah.
Sometimes the ones that won are not the ones that stay in our hearts. We'll see how it goes. Anyway, to go back to 30 minutes ago on the podcast, you wanted to segue to Kung Fu Panda 4.
I did. I was hoping we could skip over the Oscars, because it's not an interesting conversation.
I disagree, but fair enough.
Yeah, Kung Fu Panda 4 is number one at the box office. It finally beat out Dune 2.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was only like one week, wasn't it? 2 weeks?
It was your third week for Dune 2.
Okay, and, that's pretty good.
Kung Fu Panda came in, kicked it over. It's the fourth Kung Fu Panda movie.
Yeah.
I kind of hate DreamWorks animated films, just in general. I remember when Shrek came out and thinking, oh, that's going to be fun. And
yeah, it was.
Ish.
In its own. And before it became a movement.
Yeah.
It was fine.
Well,
it was a lark.
Here's my issue with Shrek. They spend a lot of time in dialogue in Shrek talking about how revolting the ogre is.
Yeah.
Like, he lives in mud, and he farts, and he smells, and he eats his own earwax.
Right.
And
which, to be fair, you're not supposed to do.
To be fair. But they introduce him with, first of all, they use All Star, which I think was the third movie I'd seen that song used in.
That was an immediate cliche. That was
hilarious. Like, All Star played over the credits of Mystery Man in 99. It was in Rat Race, which I think was 2002. So this one was right in the middle. It was Shrek. And yet they designed the character, Shrek, to be like this friendly, Disney-fied, mascot-ready face.
I mean, yeah.
He's like, and because this was 2001 CGI, they didn't really have like the animation technology yet to really gunk up that movie and like busy up the frame.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't as revolting as it said. And as such, the satire that this revolting creature is going to inhabit a Disney picture didn't land. It was really safe and drab. And then it ended with Smash Mouth covering I'm a Believer by the Monkees, which I like Smash Mouth. I'm not going to impugn Smash Mouth.
No.
And I would never impugn the Monkees.
Yes. Yet the Monkees were the Smash Mouth of their day. I mean, the Smash Mouth didn't have their own show, but they were just bright, fun bands, you know? Yeah, there was no drama, there was no darkness.
You cram all of that together in Shrek, and it's just, like, insufferably pop in a way that I just didn't appreciate. And that seemed to be the mold they followed for a while. I didn't see the movie Shark Tale, but I did see some of their films like Sinbad and The Road to El Dorado, and well-animated pictures, but not really terrifically interesting. They were leaning way too hard into, like, really terrible comedy.
Yeah.
The one exception to all of this, of course, was the big debut, which was The Prince of Egypt.
Which was an ambitious epic.
Which is ambitious. And I liked that one. I liked The Prince of Egypt a lot. But then they started doing stuff like Kung Fu Panda, and I didn't see the first Kung Fu Panda, I saw the second Kung Fu Panda.
Oh, weird. Okay.
I'm not sure what the circumstances were that I had to watch just the second. And I haven't seen the third one, but now I've seen the fourth one.
Okay.
The only ones that have really landed for me were the Aardman films, and those are just distributed by DreamWorks. That's a different studio doing it.
Chicken Run, Wallace and Gromit, those are the
Pirates Band of Misfits.
Was that technically DreamWorks?
That was a DreamWorks picture.
Okay, that is one of the best movies.
Yeah, that was really good. I even liked Early Man, which I know not a lot of people saw. And here we are with Kung Fu Panda 4, and they're just sort of leaning on their old shtick again, where we're going to have this sort of classical kind of boring adventure story that you might get out of a screenplay book.
Yeah.
And we're going to throw in some comedy bits where Jack Black just gets to mug and do anachronistic language. And
not as much as you might think.
And, in his the way he ports himself.
Okay.
In purport. He is a modern character.
Okay.
He doesn't like make references to like Chris Pine like they did in that terrible Pinocchio picture.
Yes.
And he goes on an adventure.
Yes.
There's funny, frantic comedic bits that are academically funny, setups that don't really elicit any kind of laughter. They're shaped like jokes, but they're not funny like jokes. And then the picture ends, and the kids have eaten their popcorn, and you go home. It's the baseline reading of an animated picture. It's like the movie you make to hold a place that there's a movie there before you do things like add interesting story or character or artistry.
Uh-huh.
It is unbearably bland, And it just, it angers me when I have to see a movie like this, that this kind of pablum is just sort of flopping out into theaters without any kind of wit or effort whatsoever.
What happened to you?
What happened to me? I saw Kung Fu Panda 4.
No, I'm gonna stop you right there, because I saw Kung Fu Panda 4 with you.
Yeah.
We laughed. We had a good time. You were amused.
Vaguely.
When I said at the end, and I mean this, I think it's the best Kung Fu Panda movie. I mean, I realize for you that's not a high bar, and you haven't even seen them all, but you didn't seem disgusted by it.
No, well, because it's not disgusting. It's just... It's just really dull, and you know, the more I'm thinking about it, it's like, wait, what am I taking from this?
Yeah.
What's the lesson here? There's nothing there.
I actually disagree with that.
There's no there.
No, I actually disagree with that, and I actually quite like this movie. It's not an all-timer. Mm-hmm. But I like this movie a lot, and it shows something that the Kung Fu Panda movies do that I think very few animated franchises really get to do. Kung Fu Panda, as you mentioned, it's from DreamWorks, and DreamWorks, not all of their movies are the same, but they tend to have a shtick.
Yeah,
they tend to have a certain kind of DreamWorks humor. My favorite DreamWorks films are the ones that tend to not do that. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Aardman films, but also Mr. Peabody and Sherman. Is just like it's a good story about being a single gay dad.
They don't
flat out say it, but that's what the movie is about. How to Train Your Dragon is very good. I think the second one works. Third one not so much. But like it's just a kind of a classical adventure story.
How to Train Your Dragon.
They're quite solid. They're quite solid.
I give an exception to those because those are quite good.
And one that I know you loved, Captain Underpants.
Okay, I did love Captain
Underpants. Captain Underpants is a legit classic. If Calvin and Hobbes had gotten a movie, that's kind of what we would have wanted.
Right.
That's as close as we're ever going
to
get.
I guess I'm referring more to, first of all, they started with ants, which...
No, that's definitely setting the template. I'm not going to... I agree it's a majority situation.
I don't like the Shrek movies. I hate the Madagascar movies. Over the Hedge took an interesting comic strip and drained it of personality.
Yeah.
Do you remember the Over the Hedge comic strip?
I love the Over the Hedge comic strip. And what drained... I worked on one of the video game tie-ins to that. It was the video game version on the PSP, the PlayStation Portable. I was on that doing like quality testing for like 6 months.
Gee whiz.
Just for this like game that takes an hour and a half to beat. 10 hours a day. That's not an exaggeration. That was a rough gig. I lost a lot of enthusiasm for Over the Hedge after that.
I imagine you would, yeah.
Yeah.
They made Turbo, which I also did not like. They made Home, which I also did not like. Mm-hmm. They did those Trolls movies, which are really obnoxious.
They're not bad.
I didn't see films like Abominable.
Yeah. Abominable's pretty good.
Yeah, what else did I... Oh, I didn't see the Croods movies either.
I actually missed those too.
I've heard were like really visually interesting.
Yeah. Anyway, my point is this. DreamWorks tends to have a house style, and I think Kung Fu Panda mostly eschews that. It's got silly jokes, but it is...
Orion in the Dark. I thought that was a Netflix film.
No, yeah, I think Netflix just acquired distribution. That came out recently. We both really liked it. No, the Kung Fu Panda movies, there are stories about personal growth in a way that I think most animated films fail to be over multiple films. Usually someone goes on like a journey over the course of one film, and then over the course of the later films, they become kind of hangouts. either we do the same shtick over and over again, we have to relearn the same lesson in Frozen 2, yeah. or if we do incorporate something, it's kind of like we can't be as bold or as daring because we have to sort of protect all the characters and make sure everyone sort of stays in their lanes so we can keep selling the products. And Kung Fu Panda is, it's in there in the title, it's a Kung Fu movie. And the thing about Kung Fu is that Kung Fu, it actually is about self-improvement. It's not really about fighting. That's almost coincidental. It is about discipline. It is about getting better at something by through practice, through commitment. And over the course of the Kung Fu Panda movies, we see Po, voiced by Jack Black, starting in one place. In every single film, he goes on a meaningful journey and ends up differently from where he is. And while I think the second and the third films kind of blur together for me, the fourth film, I think, is actually a really good story because he's gone on his adventures, he's kicked all the butt, and he wants to do that forever, and he's told, no, like, the next step, you still need to grow. You can never stop growing. You need to constantly pursue greater wisdom and enlightenment. And there's a greater wisdom and enlightenment than just beating people up who are starting some shit. The next step is to actually become a sage.
Yeah.
And you need to start trying to solve your problems without fighting, and then let a younger generation take over that, and then eventually they will become wiser and move on in their ways as well. And Poe doesn't think he's ready for that. And over the course of the film, he goes on an adventure with a rabbit. She's voiced by Awkwafina.
She's a fox.
I thought rabbit for a second because a lot of this movie is suspiciously similar to Zootopia, to be fair. They go to like a big metropolis with a whole bunch of different animals, and the naive animal and the streetwise animal, they clash, and they eventually learn valuable things about each other, and they grow, and it's a whole thing. They clearly saw Zootopia. It's not the end of the world, but it's a little distracting. And the villain of the piece, who's voiced by Viola Davis, is a chameleon. And her whole story is about how she wanted to learn Kung Fu. She was rejected. And now, instead of doing the work, she wants to use magic to steal people's Kung Fu. She wants to skip all of the stuff that Poe has been doing over the course of four films. And just get all the skills and none of the wisdom that comes with it.
Like, magically, yeah.
And I'm sorry, that's actually a pretty solid Kung Fu story. That's actually well considered. It's kind of wise.
It's the same subplot as the aliens in Space Jam. They just wanted to steal talent from basketball players.
That's not what they wanted. That was incidental to that movie, and you know that. This is what the movie is about. It's an important plot point in the movie, but it's not what the movie is about.
No,
that movie is about shameless marketing.
That movie's not about anything.
No, it is not. God damn it. No, this movie's about something, and I actually think it manages to tell a pretty darn good story within this universe. I like that there's this wonderful subplot where after Kung Fu Panda, I think 3, Bo has been raised by a goose. It's a goose, right?
A goose and his biological father was another panda.
I mean, he was raised by a goose played by the great James Hong. And then I think in the third film, he meets his biological father. And in this film, he's got two dads. And they don't say they're in love, but they act like a bickering couple. Yes. And I think that's really, really nice. And they go on a bit of an adventure as well. And I actually really like that just became part of it. And it's very sweet. Nobody questions it. They're fun characters. All that stuff is nice. Does it add up to much? No. But the fact that it's there is nice. And they're funny. And that's the other thing about this movie. It's actually quite funny. There's some really good comedic timing in it. There's some really good comedic gags in it. There's a wonderful chase in the middle of the movie where they're all being chased by these bulls, and the bulls are the cops because they have a metaphor. And they're being chased all throughout the town, and they're running over rooftops, and they're running through businesses, and they run through a china shop, and you're thinking, oh, I know where this is going to go. And then the bulls run into the china shop, and then they walk very slowly.
They kind of like tiptoe through, careful not to knock anything over.
Come on, I don't want to live up to that cliche. And it's like, and then they just move on. That's funny. That's a joke that doesn't happen. And that's actually funny. That's a good gag. There's good gags in this. There's a really good sequence that they come back to it multiple times about a bar that's kind of tilting over the edge of a cliff. And every time there's like a fight sequence in it, people have to like run to the other side to prevent the building from falling over, which is like a Buster Keaton gag.
Yeah.
And it's good.
It's been done better in Buster Keaton movies, though.
It's been done better in Jackie Chan movies, but still, it's part of the tradition, I feel. The overlap between physical comedy and Kung Fu, although the Kung Fu comedy really didn't come into popularity until Jackie Chan came around, but still, part of the tradition now. I think it's nicely animated, I think it's well acted, I thought it was genuinely funny, I liked all the characters, and I thought the plot actually amounted to something. Did it blow my mind? No. Did I like it? Hell yeah.
All right.
I really dug it, actually. I thought I like this better than the other Kung Fu Panda movies, of which, like, one is good.
All right.
Two and three are fine, but like I said, they just blur together for me. Like, the actual... I remember one had a different villain than the other, but other than that, you could, like, interchange the scenes, and I don't really recall.
Yeah, I watched Kung Fu Panda 2. I think I had to review Kung Fu Panda 2. It's one of those films that's like... I mean, this doesn't say a lot because my memory is terrible, but it's gone from my memory.
Yeah.
I remember, like, maybe a shot or two. Nothing really stuck with me. I'm probably going to forget about...
You were interviewing someone from the movie.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I think it might have been the director. I think.
No. I think it was what was that actor from? Hold on. Oh, that's gonna drive me up the wall. Dennis Haysbert.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. You interviewed Dennis Haysbert for that movie.
And I when you're interviewing Dennis Haysbert has a very small role in that movie, if I recall. Like he plays an ox, and his character was named Ox. Like, okay, now that you've brought it up, I remember this. And he had like a really tiny role.
Mm-hmm.
He's just doing a Dennis Haysbert voice. He's not like affecting a voice.
No, he's not playing a rich new character. He's cast as Dennis Haysbert. Yeah, he's gonna
and he sounds like Dennis Haysbert, so he doesn't need to do a lot to impress you with his voice. But I was frustratingly on topic, I think, for that interview. Like, let's stay around Kung Fu Panda 2. Like, what
I did the research, damn it.
Yeah, like, what did you do to get into Kung Fu Panda 2? And I'm asking him all about Kung Fu Panda 2. It's like, he's a broad career. I should probably ask him about, like, other roles he's had.
I think it was one of your earlier interviews. Might have been, if memory serves. I think you've gotten more on point since that. But, yeah, sometimes they don't go well.
No.
Even if you try really, really hard.
I don't think I did a bad job, but I was clearly naive and, you know, not doing well.
It's okay. I'm sure. I remember you did a good job. It was fine.
Well, thank you.
But in any case, yeah, Kung Fu Panda. I guess I liked it a lot more than you. Fair enough. Tell me about, I didn't get to see this, and I really wanted to, Love Lies Bleeding.
Okay. See, this is a movie I love. This is a slightly surreal, really stylized, fantastical, very R-rated, super horny lesbian heist movie. And we've had as many, two of these in as many months, which I'm really glad about.
Because almost as many weeks, I think.
Because just recently we had Ethan Coen's Drive Away Dolls.
Yes.
That was like a slapstick farce. This one's a little bit more steely and hard-edged.
Okay.
So Katie O'Brien plays an itinerant bodybuilder who's passing through this little tiny town on her way to a bodybuilding competition in Las Vegas in the 1980s. And she stops to work out in this like little completely run-down rinky-dink gym.
Okay.
And we're introduced to this gym through the gym's manager, a character named Lou, played by Kristen Stewart.
Yay!
And I think the first shot we see of Kristen Stewart, her hand is like deep in a toilet. Like, this is how awful this gym is. Like, the toilets are constantly clogging. The Katie O'Brien character, her name is Jackie, comes in to work out, and she's like an actual bodybuilder, so she's like super buff. And she stays after one evening to sort of chat with Lou. Lou says, "Hey, I can hook you up with some steroids because this is the 80s and we just sort of do that in these gyms."
I didn't pick up that it was the 80s. Okay, yeah.
Got it. And there's this weird sort of like Cronenbergian bonding they do, like where they're getting off sexually over like giving each other steroids shots.
And they end up
having sex right on the floor. Jackie moves in with Lou. Jackie has no other place to live. Jackie also gets a job at the local shooting range, which is owned by Ed Harris. And they give Ed Harris this really gaunt makeup and this long hair. He looks exactly like the Crypt Keeper. And he is clearly up to something really shady. And it's revealed pretty soon that he's running like guns across the border, and
like
he's up to a lot of shady mob stuff. She also gets involved with Kristen Stewart's brother, who's played by Dave Franco.
Ah.
And he is an abusive jerk to his wife, who's played by Jenna Malone.
Oh my God! What a cast!
Great cast in this.
Oh my God.
I want Jenna Malone to get some sort of like high-profile fantasy gig.
She's overdue. She's like as
a lead, because she's in those Hunger Games movies, yeah. But she's not Katniss.
And, she stole those movies. Every time she's on camera, it's all about her. She's great in everything.
In that fourth Hunger Games movie, there's a bit where Katniss and Jenna Malone say, okay, nobody's listening to us. We got to take down the bad guys. We got to break into a city and like sneak through and start murdering people and take down the system.
Yeah.
And they reach a point where it's like, okay, we've reached the portal to the underground portal to this big city. We're going to break in and start killing people. And at that point, Jenna Malone says, okay, I'm out now. It's all up to you now, Katniss. It's like, no.
Why?
No, I want to see the two of them go in there and kick ass together.
Do you remember how how the exact same fucking thing happened in the first Ghost Rider movie?
Oh, yeah, where Sam Elliott is like, he comes in on like a flaming skull and on a horse. Yeah. Like, yeah, we're going to fight the devil.
By the way, I've been
a
Ghost Rider this entire time. I'm going to be a Ghost Rider, a flaming skeleton on a horse, broad-rimmed cowboy hat, and there's this awesome shot of two fucking flaming skeletons, one on a motorcycle, one on a horse, riding to like the big climactic fight
where the devil's son is waiting there, and they're gonna kill him. It's like okay,
on paper
cool.
That sounds awesome, right? And then they get there, and Sam Elliott says, "Well, that's it for me. I saved all my power up for one last ride."
A ride?
What are you doing? Stay. What? No. Why did you? Why didn't you turn into it now? I could have used you. What are we doing here? What was that?
Also, it's fucking Sam Elliott.
Yeah, I know. Like, what are we thinking here? At least let him die in battle or something. What the shit is the matter with you?
Lies Bleeding. I appreciate just how sort of forthright this film is about its violence and its sex. There's a lot of sex in the movie that communicates where they are in their relationship at that moment. How things are getting kind of increasingly desperate. It gets very raw after a while. As the film progresses and things become like increasingly unhinged, some fantastical things begin happening, like non-realistic things. There's a scene in this movie that wouldn't have been out of place in a Marvel movie.
Really? Are we supposed to take that literally, do you think? Or do you think that's, like, subjective?
That's up to you.
So you think you can have it both ways, you think?
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, that's exciting.
Yeah, like a character does see it as like comments on this like fantastical thing that's happening.
Interesting.
But it's also, you know, kind of a metaphor as well.
Interesting.
And golly, I love me a raw, hard-edged queer heist movie with fantasy elements in it and Cronenbergian needle sex. Like this is freaking great.
Whereas I'm tired of that genre. Yeah, it's been done to death.
It was written and directed by Rose Glass, who I'm not terribly familiar with.
Did it Saint Maud? Didn't she?
Yeah, Saint Maud was like her big debut.
Yeah,
and some shorts as well. So if Love Lies Bleeding is any indicator, then Saint Maud is probably freaking fantastic.
I've heard nothing but amazing things. It's probably like the best reviewed horror movie from the last few years that I never got around to seeing, and I need to. I've heard nothing but amazing things about it. I think it kept getting delayed for some nonsense reason, but might have just been COVID. Now I really want to see this fucking movie and I'm mad at myself. Well, I will definitely catch up to it.
Okay.
Thank you. Next up, we have a movie, and this might seem a little repetitive to you, but, it's a movie about, people who invent a fictional messiah and then have to sort of make other people believe in that. And then it gets totally out of control. Now the people who created this fictional messiah are the ones who are in trouble.
Mm.
2 weeks in a row we've had that. Because that was Dune Part 2. And that is also the plot of Ricky Stenicki.
Oh, God.
Ricky Stenicki is a kind of a high concept comedy. It stars Zac Efron and a couple other guys whose names escape me. And I should probably look those up. But it's a trio of friends. And when they were kids, there was a Halloween prank that went horribly wrong. And they almost burned down a house. And they didn't want to get in trouble. So they left an article of clothing behind, and they wrote a fictional kid's name on it. So that kid would be Blink.
Oh, okay.
And that kid's name was Ricky Stenicki. Bullshit name that came up on the top of their bat. But here's the thing. It worked.
Ah, okay.
People believed. I thought you saw this.
No.
Oh, for some reason, I thought you did. Okay, so people believed that there's this Ricky Stenicki kid. He did it. We can't find him. Okay, well, no harm, no foul. I guess no one died. And then there's a whole montage in the credits about them throughout their entire childhood. Every time some shit happened, you found pot in my room? I was holding that for Ricky Stenicki. And after a while, their parents were like...
This is like Lady for a Day.
A little.
They're going to have to hire somebody to be Ricky Stenicki.
Exactly. Okay. So after a while, their parents start getting embarrassed that like they're too embarrassed to admit they haven't met the kid, so they just assume that they have, and they just the lie has grown and grown. Now they're all in their 30s, and Ricky Stenicki, still alive, is now has now graduated from a ne'er-do-well. How often do well?
Ne'er.
To a saint. He now spends all of his time overseas doing charity work. And so, because that is more useful to them as an excuse now.
They've invented, like, this ne'er-do-well who has redeemed himself.
Yes, and they can use... The fact that he's a good guy means now they have an excuse whenever he's in town. Oh, we have to do stuff with Ricky Stenicki. Okay. So at the beginning, when they're having a baby shower, one of them is about to have a baby, they're called at the last minute. There's a call on their phone from Ricky Stenicki. Oh, my God. The cancer is back. We have to go take care of Ricky. He doesn't have his family there. And so their wife's like, no, go see your childhood friend. That's more important. It's fine. I know this was a big deal, but that's more important. And then they get in their car and they go to Atlantic City because they're selfish dicks.
Because they don't want to go to a baby shower.
Because they don't want to go to a baby shower and they got like free tickets to a concert. So they're going to do that instead. And they get really wasted. And while they're there, there's a lot of setup in this movie, so forgive me for a minute. While they're there, they meet an out-of-work actor who goes by the name of Rockhard Rod, and he's played by John Cena. Rockhard Rod's...
Oh, John Cena.
His bread and butter... He's funny.
He is so game, man.
He is a legitimately funny comic actor. I will give him mad props.
Watch Blockers.
This is not a great movie, but he's great in it, and I will give him that. His whole bit is that he, like, performs at strip clubs doing cover songs, but he changes the lyrics so it's jokes about masturbation.
Okay.
That's his whole thing. He's miserable, he's an alcoholic, he's addicted to steroids, he's not having a good life. But when shit goes down and now all of a sudden their families are really, really mad at them, and the only way to get out of it is either admit that Ricky Stenicki isn't real, or produce the real Ricky Stenicki. Mm. They call this out-of-work actor, because nobody knows him, to come in and be Ricky Stenicki. They give him... They literally call it the Bible of Ricky Stenicki.
Written down, like, his whole... Oh, gosh.
Yeah, just so they have the continuity right. They need to make sure their stories are straight, but this has been going on for decades, so it's just like this thick book. And he's such a method actor that he memorizes it, he does all the ancillary research.
Oh, he's like a good actor.
He's actually a good actor, and... He also, just to be better than Daniel Day-Lewis, he changes his name legally to Ricky Stenicki, which is actually a funny joke. And then he has to show up at a big party. They're having a bris for the baby. Mm. And will anyone figure out it's really him? Will he stand up to the challenge every time someone tests him? It turns out he actually did research that, and he's actually really good. And you think that's where the movie is going, and then it keeps going.
Oh, no.
After that, and he just won't leave their lives, and now, oh, my God, now we're stuck with Ricky Stenicki, and we've actually, like, created a monster, and that's the movie. Okay.
If... I didn't see this movie.
I know you didn't. Now I know.
But, if the story was Ricky Stenicki, like, lives with them, but they've invented this sort of, like, saintly character, and he won't stop being a saintly character, and he actually begins to redeem them... And turn their lives around, not in a comedy way, like actually makes them better. That might be an interesting story.
That's basically this movie.
Okay.
And honestly, structurally, it's kind of okay. It's it's so much about its plot that the main characters kind of just disappear. Mm. Zac Efron isn't playing a particularly interesting guy. They keep adding this like backstory where he had like a kind of an abusive dad, and that's all very sad. Don't get me wrong, but it doesn't excuse what he's doing. He's done a lot of really shitty things. But yeah, the joke is. They call it the Bible. They invented, like, a fake, like, messianic figure. Mm. And they gave it to a guy who actually needed to turn his life around. And by telling him, here, live the life of the perfect person, he started to do that.
Hmm.
And it actually worked. And there's something kind of interesting about that in terms of, like, yeah, you know, this movie seems to argue in a metaphoric way that even if religion is fake, and I realize, you know, you may or not believe that, but even if it is... If it does good, how bad can it be? And is it even so bad that you invented it? The answer in this case is yes, they invented it for incredibly selfish reasons and betrayed the people that they loved over the course of many decades, and they get off really light. So that part doesn't work.
But if they're redeemed, then, you know, if they become they're redeemed a little
bit. They're redeemed a little bit. Their lives are improved, and everything more or less turns out okay. It's a happy comedy. It's an R-rated comedy. It really didn't need to be. There's really not as much raunchiness as you might think. There's a scene at the Briss in which, oh my god, someone might wackily, like in an amusing way, ruin the circumcision. And I'm like, that baby could be seriously injured. That's not actually that funny.
Please don't injure the baby.
Well, yeah, that's not funny. That's a weird joke. I don't think that would work.
I've been to a Briss.
Okay.
And the rabbi made a joke.
A joke? Like, fine.
And no, like a tasteless joke.
Oh, a tasteless joke. Oh my god.
Like, it's like, this is a tradition. This is something I went through. Yeah. And I know it's really rough because after my Briss, I couldn't walk for a year.
Okay, I've heard that joke before. That's. I think if you're a Moyle, you get to make that joke, probably.
It's like 80-year-old rabbi. I got to do. It's like a
He's allowed. Well done. Yeah. Here, there's a little too much of a physical threat, which I don't think is fun. Here's the thing with this movie. It's got an interesting premise. It's actually it's actually thematically interesting in a way that most comedies aren't. Here's where it falls apart. It's not funny.
Oh, that's an issue.
Like, almost ever, there's, like, I laughed, like, out loud, like, maybe 4 times.
All right.
That's not good. That's a very bad percentage. This is not a short movie. So, like, that sucks. It's impossible to hate John Cena, though. That's the thing. He's just seems like a really cool guy. You know, he has a world record for the most Make-A-Wish wishes granted.
Oh, well, good for him.
Like, how can you be mad at that? He seems like such a cool guy.
He's so game to go back to the Oscars. Yeah. He presented the Oscar for Best Costumes in the nude.
Yeah.
Like, he had, like, a little covering, but... Yeah, but he was essentially
nude. Like, it was quite bearing all, and it was funny. Mm-hmm. He did it live. He was a genuinely funny performer. I got nothing but respect for John Cena. He is the best part of this movie. If the movie works at all, it's because of him. If the movie doesn't work at all, it's because the screenplay isn't funny. And I'm sorry, I can only give you so much credit as a comedy if you're not actually funny. So this could have been quite good. It could have also been quite bad. And the reason it's not bad is because of John Cena, and the reason it's not good is because of everything else.
Yeah.
Unfortunate. And then lastly, you're going to tell me about American Dreamer.
American Dreamer. This is a comedy film that was based on a story from This American Life.
Okay.
And they changed a lot of the details, though. In the movie, Peter Dinklage plays an economics professor who is, and we see in his life that things aren't going so well for him. He's kind of impoverished. He has to eat lunches out of vending machines. He's really unhappy, and he dreams of home ownership. He wants to have a house. He believes in that. And he's constantly sort of buzzing around open houses that are hosted by a friend of his who's played by Matt Dillon.
Okay.
He lands on the sweetheart deal. He can pay just $250,000, and he'll move into this little guest house of a gigantic mansion that is occupied by one elderly tenant, played by Shirley MacLaine.
Okay.
And
that's a good cast.
If he lives there until she dies, he gets the house free and clear. So it's like, I can pay $250,000 and get this mansion and wait for this old lady to die.
It sounds like a Three Stooges
Kind of. Evidently, this is a real story. In the real story, it was a young woman, and the tenant was an old man.
Okay.
They flipped it around. And I don't know if the real woman was an economics professor.
But the basic premise is there.
And he is a total sluggish layabout, just really unlucky. When he gets an injury, he puts duct tape on it rather than a bandage. And yet, and this is where you can tell why Peter Dinklage took this role, he is irresistible to women. And it's embarrassing how irresistible he is to women. For a bit, he's approached by one of his students. It's like, you were always my favorite professor. I've always been attracted to you, professor. And it's okay, because I'm actually, even though I look like I'm 19, I'm really 30. And this is totally okay. So, and of course, they have an affair.
Well, that's inappropriate.
One of the old woman is said to not have any children, which is why she can afford to sort of give the mansion to a tenant. But then these people keep coming in. More and more people keep coming in. Just like, these are my kids. It's like, wait, you said she didn't have any kids. Yeah. And they're all, getting really protective of her. And, are you moving in on Shirley MacLaine? And one of the most vocal of them, threatens to take him to court is this woman who's a little bit more his age. And wouldn't you know it, they start having wine together. Okay. And he's really irresistible to her.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, by the end of the movie, he and Shirley MacLaine start bonding and having a little bit of romantic overtures.
I mean, I just pay to see a romantic movie with Peter Dinklage and Shirley MacLaine.
Wouldn't that be nice? The problem is it's rather unfocused. It doesn't really focus on the fact that, you know, this very simple premise, this Three Stooges premise, where it's like, okay, I have to move in, I have to spend time with Shirley MacLaine.
Yeah.
And at first we hate each other, but then we start to like each other. It's simple.
It's a comedic setup. Sorry, yeah. Just dropped the pen,
I don't mind a cliched setup if the jokes work and the comedy lands.
Yeah, just get us to the jokes. Yeah. That's all we're here for.
But they keep on trying to sort of roll with the sort of like slobbish darkness of this main character. Hmm. And he's just kind of a terrible character. Aww. Like, Peter Dinklage is a very good actor.
Well, I think you cast Peter Dinklage, you assume he can make any terrible character charming.
Yeah.
And to an extent, he can.
And he's a charming... I don't know why he's not doing that here. Why he's just letting this character be just kind of a loutish asshole throughout. And, you know, he's playing a loutish asshole well, but that doesn't make the film appealing.
Well, he might have been asked to, you know?
Maybe so. Maybe it was just sort of misdirected.
Or they thought it was a good idea and it didn't work out. And what can you do? Now it's too late, you know?
Yeah, so...
Yeah, Peter Dinklage didn't do enough with it.
So the film isn't terribly funny, and it comes across as really caustic and kind of embarrassing. Which is a pity, because there are some screenplays you can tell were written as, like, fantasies from the screenwriter's perspective.
Sure.
Watch anything written by Joel Esterhaz.
Jesus.
Sort of bring up his name, you know, if you remember him. I don't think he's still writing.
I think the last thing he wrote, actually. He was the highest paid screenwriter in the world for a while.
For a second there, in the mid-90s.
Yeah, they could do no wrong with Basic Instinct.
Joe Esterhaus wrote Basic Instinct. He wrote Showgirls. You can kind of tell the weird sort of porno angle he was bringing to those movies.
Yeah, what was the last thing he did?
Didn't he do something kind of classy, too?
He did some interesting shit. Hang on. I'll try to find... Oh, wait, no. I'm looking under the wrong thing. Hang on. I'll find it. You keep talking.
But yeah, he was... He was hot shit for a second there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, he also did Flashdance. Like, those kinds of movies. Mm.
All right. Joe Esterhaus recently did... He hadn't been working for a while. His last project was in 2022.
That was a Hungarian movie.
It was called The Impact. And it was a... Mm. Oh, it was like a collaborative filmmaking... thing. It's a 37 short films made by... Okay, so he's just one of many filmmakers who co-worked on this, like, anthology film. But before that, his last thing was in 2006 called Children of Glory. He hasn't, like, worked, like, had, like, his own thing published since 1997 with Alan Smithy.
That's a terrible movie. Yeah, but that's like an aggressively terrible movie.
But yeah, he did Basic Instinct. He did Sliver. He did Showgirls. He did Jade.
All these like sexy movies.
If it was sleazy and got a big release in the 90s, it was probably him. He did Fist with Arnold Stallone.
I haven't seen Fist.
I haven't seen it either.
Now I need to go back.
It's a union film. He looks like a union boss. Yeah. It's one of the first things he did right after Rocky, actually.
Yeah, and throughout the 90s, he was, like, notoriously one of the highest-paid screenwriters. Yeah. Like, people are giving him millions of dollars for two-page treatments.
Yeah, he wrote it on a napkin. Here, boom, $1 million. God.
Isn't that the dream?
God, like, that's a dream right there, man.
Like, yeah, you have two gins and just write down some bullshit on a napkin and you get millions of dollars.
The older I get, the more I appreciate the dream of
it. It's about a rough sex expert, and she gets involved in a detective...
It's just in a detective, in there. Yeah. Like, you saw Osmosis Jones. It's all up in there.
We shrink her down, you see. Anyway.
Everything you just described is like every Shannon Tweed movie.
Anyway, American Dream was
that retrospective.
Good.
Shannon Tweed is owed a retrospective, I think.
There are some around.
But no, I mean like at the Egyptian... Like a movie screening series of Shannon Tweed's best works.
It wasn't Shannon Tweed in particular, but there was, on the Criterion Channel, a whole celebration of 90s erotic thrillers.
That's true, but they mostly didn't do the straight-to-video stuff, and that is a whole world of its own. There was a good documentary that came out last year, I reviewed it on this show, that focused mostly on the straight-to-video erotic thriller boom. And it was called, it's We Something... I have it right here. We Kill for Love.
Okay.
If you have any interest in the erotic thriller genre, not in just a pure prurient sexy way, but actually like that was an art form and that was like a whole fucking cinematic movement. It's a long movie, but it's pretty thorough and it'll give you food for thought. We Kill for Love. Really good. Anyway, we're off in the weeds. American Dreamer, last thoughts.
I mean, it's simply not very good. It's a little too caustic for its comedy to function, and it's not as high concept as it thinks it is. Mm-hmm. It's pretty simple setup for a comedy film, and it's trying to. Because it's called American Dreamer, it's trying to link its themes up with, you know, homeownership as being a big part of the American dream, but it doesn't talk about that a lot. It's so not really about that.
Man.
And it ends up being about, and then there's, you know, sort of a revelation about the Shirley MacLaine character at the end, which doesn't feed into any kind of theme. It's just sort of like a plot surprise.
Oh, okay, great. All right, well, on that note, let's do our movie review roundup. We review movies on a scale of C- to C+. The lowest the movie can get is a C-. That's below average. That's a movie we don't recommend for one reason or another, to one degree or another. A C is average. Most movies are average. Some good, some bad, more for one audience than another. And a C-plus is anything we think is above average, whether we quite like it or think it's the best movie ever made. On that note, Whitney, American Dreamer.
It's a C-. It's just not that good.
That's a shame, that is. Let's see. Ricky Stenicki. It's a low C.
Okay.
It would be a C+ if the script were good, and it would be a C- if John Cena wasn't in it.
Okay.
So that's where it's
at. He's the saving grace.
Yeah, he really is the MVP. Like, I don't know, whatever they paid him, they should have doubled it. Because if that movie is good at all, it's because of him. Love Lies Bleeding.
C+.
That, nice.
It's one of the better films I've seen so far this year. I know it's only March, but...
Yeah, still.
You know what? I saw... Skinamarink last year in like February.
That was January, actually.
It was early in the year. Yeah. It's like,
Megan came out early as well.
If I see something like better than this throughout the year, this is going to be a great year. And it ended up being on my top 10 list.
So. Always nice. And then Kung Fu Panda 4.
That's a C-. So you do not need to watch this movie.
It's a C+. You don't need to watch this movie, but I do think that if you're people who like Kung Fu Panda, it's a popular franchise, this is one of the better installments. I happen to think it's the best installment.
All right.
And if you've never seen Kung Fu Panda, you can just plop right into this and you'll get it. And it's funny. It's brisk. It's not too long. Like, it doesn't outstay its welcome. It doesn't pretend it's like this huge thing that it's not. Just this rock solid animated comedy. And as someone who loves Kung Fu movies in particular, it actually understands what Kung Fu movies are about beyond the fights. And that's something that I think very few martial arts movies in America ever really do. And I admire that. I think that's kind of noble, actually. So I come at it from a different angle.
All right.
Next time on Critically Acclaimed, we'll be reviewing some other stuff. It's not actually that big a... It's not actually that big a week.
Well,
I think
done,
about
man.
It. Like, what's coming out this week? Irish Wish.
Irish Wish.
It's a new Lindsay Lohan romantic comedy. Where she is I think she's the maid of honor at a wedding in Ireland, and she is in love with the guy who's getting married, and she wishes she had told him that she loved him, and maybe their situation would be reversed, and then wouldn't you know it, she wakes up, and now she's marrying him, and the bride is now her maid of honor, and she got her wish, she went back in time. But maybe it's not what she really wanted.
I wonder if she'll discover something about herself.
Sold. That's exactly what I wanted. Thank you, Netflix. Thank you, Lindsay Lohan. I have no idea if it's any good or not, but like when people say, like, who asked for this? I asked for that one. That one was me. I want more dopey romantic comedies, please. Bring them back.
I want Lindsay Lohan to win.
Because
she was very poorly treated by the public at large for too long.
Yeah, like a lot of young actors, people were very unkind to her, and they were very unforgiving about like her like kind of moving away from child stardom into adult stardom. And you know what? She's talented.
She is talented.
She's legitimately talented.
There's a reason she became a movie star, and then she was struggling very publicly with some addictions, and people were not giving her any slack. They weren't helping her. They were mocking her addiction.
Assholes about it. Yeah.
She ended up having to flee the country, and she just sort of like stayed out of the public eye for a little bit. She ended up spending a lot of time in like beach resorts just to sort of relax and enjoy her life.
Good for her.
And she ended up buying beach resorts. Like, she started her own. It's like,
good,
I like this life.
Yeah.
This is what I'm going to do. So she has her own resorts.
She doesn't have to work. She gets to if she wants to.
I don't know where they are. I think they're like in Bali or something.
Yeah.
You can go to Bali and go to like the Lohan Resort, and she owns that. It's like, good. And she's slowly, very slowly, been returning to Hollywood and sort of smaller projects.
Yep.
She clearly wants to do acting again. I want to see her just sort of be light and funny and ply her talents again. It's like Robert Downey Jr. winning an Oscar. It's like, I'm happy you won an Oscar. You're a great actor, but I'm grateful you're alive.
You didn't burn out. He had a really rough go of it for a while there, and he came out the other end. Better for it. Yeah.
Before we close out, a story about Robert Downey Jr., because I read this recently. You'll recall in the first Iron Man movie, there's a scene after he went through sort of the cave ordeal and built his Iron Man suit, and he was kind of traumatized, where he gives a press release, like a press conference, and he just sort of collapses and just says, I need a cheeseburger, feed me a cheeseburger. Everything's like low at this point.
Yeah.
And that's based on a true story.
Oh.
Where, of Robert Downey Jr.'s own personal low point. He's been very open about how he was addicted to drugs at one point.
He was considered like unhirable in Hollywood. He was on Ally McBeal. That was supposed to be his big comeback thing. Mm-hmm. Everyone loved him. It did not work out. He ended up falling way back on it.
And he remembers his low point. It's like people were out of the house and he was like digging through where he was hiding his drugs. It's like, because that's what addicts do. They hide their drugs. And he brought it all into his car. And he's like, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I have all my drugs in my car. And he went to get a burger at Burger King and he ate it while he's driving around. Mm. And he looked at the burger and it was so bad. It was like such a terrible experience eating this drive-thru burger. This is barely food for me. I'm sorry if you like Burger King, but clearly Robert Downey Jr. did not. This is not good for me. It's doing something horrible to my body. Is this what my life is? Driving around with drugs in my car, eating things that are barely. How does this end for me? Like, am I going to keep on getting these fast food burgers, or am I going to stop eating shit and turn my life around? And he drove straight to the beach. And he threw all his drugs in the ocean. And from that moment on, he's been clean.
Thank you, Burger King.
So Burger King, for feeding such a shitty burger to Robert Downey Jr., saved his life. And so I'm grateful to Burger King for that.
Thank you, Burger King. Well done indeed. I had never heard that before. That's
I only recently came up on that story. So anyway, I think that was really good.
Anyway, that's it for Critically Acclaimed. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you for joining us. If you want to listen to our shows ad-free, if you want to get access to a whole bunch of exclusive shows, head on over to patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We're incredibly grateful to all of our patrons. We couldn't do this without you. We wouldn't want to do it without you. So thank you for everything. Thank you, everyone, who showed up to our Oscar Trivia Night on Patreon last weekend. It was a lot of fun. Here's a fun fact. How many people named Oscar have won an Academy Awards?
you told me this. Yeah, that's a fun one to look up.
One. Only one person named Oscar has ever won an Academy Award, and it was Oscar Hammerstein, the song composer. That's amazing to me. Like, what are the odds? Anyway, that was fun. So thank you to all of our patrons. If you want to talk about anything we discussed in this episode, our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. What is our P.O. Box?
Send us a physical letter to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
I'm currently editing our latest episode of We've Got Mail, so that'll debut in a day or two. It's all going to come together.
Thanks for doing that.
You're welcome. And we're on social media, @CriticAcclaim. I'm @WilliamBibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibold. And we're on Blue Sky more than anything. Go to Blue Sky.
I'm kind of half and half, and I'm trying to lean towards Blue Sky more. Anyway, that's it. That's it. We're done. Go home. Or be home. Or drive safely. Anyway, never forget everyone's a critic.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?